Both were willing to concede the potential of paranormal phenomena from their previous study of the subject, but both were wary of the possibility of fakery. Even more disconcerting had been a discussion with Altimira concerning another A explanation at EM for the phenomena. Belk wrote in his notes, A now the most interesting point Altimira said was that Fabiano de Cristo, the 13th century monk who was supposed to be one of Arago at EM's sources of assistance, had a green ray which was the source of the effectiveness of the operations. This negated pain, the necessity for antisepsis, controlled the flow of blood in the operations, etc. This ray was invisible to Puharich and me. For certain, Arago and his helpers can at EMT explain it, and after 5 years, they take the whole thing for granted. Maybe I need smoked glasses at EM. Puharich was inclined to table the whole strange concept of Dr. Fritz and his alleged colleagues in favor of concentrating on the empirical medical facts about Arago. This was a big enough job in itself, without this imponderable complication that seemed to grow out of the Brazilian tradition entrenched in the Kardec philosophy. When they left S.A. Tilda Pondo Paulo for Rio, the two American researchers encountered some of the background of this intellectualized form of spiritism. Spiritism differs from spiritualism, in that it emphasizes healing. Spiritualism had been so much in currency in England and the United States in the time of William James, and still continues with less intensity. Adherents of both forms believe that legitimate mediums, or asensitivists at EM, can document cases of telepathy, clairvoyance, and precognition, and, in some cases, communication with the deceased. Further, the spiritists point out, studies of mediums by such responsible researchers as William James, Sir William Crookes, and other scientists of the era had shown that evidence of automatic writing, where the medium becomes an instrument of an alleged deceased spirit, pointed inescapably to their being in COM 49, communication with what they called the spirit world. The Kardecists of Brazil, including doctors and scientists, were going beyond this. They felt that this paranormal power could be harnessed for medical use, and claimed to have enough real evidence of its effectiveness to bring important medical results in patients that modern medicine could not help. In Rio, Belk and Puharich explored this prevalent attitude in greater depth, both with John Lawrence, the RCA and NASA executive engineer, and Luis Rodriguez, a retired pharmaceutical manufacturer who had turned almost all his time and attention to trying to consolidate modern psychiatry with the best nuggets of truth and technique culled from a careful sifting of primitive psychiatry and medicine. He felt that Freud, Jung, Adler, and the other pioneers had stopped far short of getting at the roots of the real causes of psychosis and neurosis. He would only concede that the theories of Freud at EMS era were valid up to a point. Rodriguez agreed with Puharich and Belk that ESP and other aspects of mediumship unquestionably exist, but that the vast majority of those calling themselves mediums were either outright frauds or entertaining magicians. The three also agreed that psychic healing existed in various forms, from the time of Jesus and before to the modern psychiatrist in his treatment of psychosomatic disorders. They also agreed on other, more esoteric aspects of parapsychology, but Rodrigues at EMS main point was that this sort of phenomenon was prevalent all throughout Brazil, and that Arago was only one of many who had displayed similar powers. The others were not quite as dramatic surgically, but nonetheless showed strong evidence of bringing about almost impossible cures in patients given up by doctors. John Lawrence concurred in the assessment of Arago at EMS near miraculous surgery. He was also convinced that there was no fakery involved, as had been found in the Philippine healers. But he felt that Arago should be considered in context with the entire psychic healing scene that had historically grown up in the ambience of Brazil. After careful study, Lawrence had found that it was not possible to deny 50, the reality of results obtained by Kardecist doctors, who, despite their impressive conventional medical training, called on mediums to buttress their diagnoses and treatment. As a cautious student of psychic phenomena, Lawrence was finding that as he learned more about the field, the fanatical, superstitious, and noisy elements became less important, provided that the same cold light of reason he applied in his scientific work was used as a tough screen to filter out the static. His background and experience was highly technical and exacting. Working with advanced space vehicle systems and the NASA satellite programs allows little room for error, and he brought the same discipline to his investigations of the paranormal. Lawrence was impressed by the fact that the Kardecists in Brazil had established two large hospitals associated with medical schools that enrolled over 2,000 students for a four-year course. They combined the study of traditional medicine with the practical use of mediums as an adjunct that could supply therapy that simply was not available in the channels of orthodox medicine. In this way, they found cures that could be obtained in no other way. One of the techniques employed here was a form of psychic surgery considered more sophisticated than that of Arago. It employed mediums who claim they were instruments of a group of deceased doctors and surgeons, just as Arago claimed. Both, therefore, were following one of the tenets of Alan Kardec, which said, "The spiritual world is in constant contact with the material world, each reacting constantly on the other." Kardec, aware of how difficult this premise would be for the skeptical world to swallow, added, "This is what the spirits themselves have dictated. If your reason says A no at M, then reject it." There were obviously many who did reject it, but in Brazil there were many who did not. They included the educated Kardecists and the untutored masses of Umbandists and Quimbandists. And it was among these adherents, and others willing to experiment when everything else in medicine failed, that the Kardec-trained psychic mediums worked. Their technique involved surgery on what the Kardecists 51 call the spiritual, or etheric, body. The trained mediums use actual surgical instruments, and the patient is placed on an operating table. All the motions of regular surgical procedure are followed, but no incision is made, because the motions are conducted a few inches from the body of the patient. The scene becomes an exacting pantomime of an operation in a modern hospital. The theory is that the mediums are operating on the spiritual body, which they consider to be very real, and the results will follow in the physical body. An enormous number of successful cases have been verified by responsible doctors, but the concept of psychic surgery is so alien to the average person that the process remains largely unknown in the Western world. From the North American point of view, the radical nature of the concept is so remote and strange that qualified scientists would quite naturally have dismissed it out of hand. Evidence that the scope of future research would go far beyond Arago was indicated by the fact that Brazilian Air Force medical doctors were studying another medium in northern Brazil who was performing operations very similar to those of Arago. Puharich and Belk were intrigued, but the documentation of Arago was a massive enough job in itself. Studying Arago would at least be dealing with actual surgery, even if the underlying cause spun out into the remote unknown. Arago also provided a clear, single focus for clinical study, as strange as it was. And even here, the problems were monumental. Simply delimiting the extent of the research would be a demanding job. While it would be tempting to extend the research because of what was happening elsewhere in Brazil, it would be simply impractical. Rodriguez propounded some interesting theories that went beyond the study of Arago. He felt that the Kardecist concepts, which were basically beyond the mystic religious beliefs of the past, could be organized and presented in an objective, matter-of-fact manner that would solicit science to assist in making breakthroughs in the nature and mechanics of these esoteric phenomena. As a result, equally new breakthroughs might follow in medicine, electronics, and 52, even economics and politics. As a further result, the basic nature of man might be developed and brought up to the level of his runaway materialistic progress. Rodriguez was strong on the theory that modern psychiatry had bypassed many truths by ignoring the primitive medicine manitiam's inclusion of the so-called spirit world as far as psychosis and neurosis were concerned. Arago, by demonstrating what a simple, uneducated peasant could do, symbolized this vacuum in modern research. Rodriguez encouraged Belk and Puharich to follow up strongly, and offered any help he could give them when they returned to Brazil. The whole complex phenomenon was in the wind almost everywhere in Brazil, and some of it filtering to Europe and North America. But harnessing that wind was another problem. By the time Belk and Puharich were preparing to leave Rio, the press had seized on Arrigo's TMS operation on Puharich, and the story was spread across the country in blazing headlines. Arrigo, in fact, seemed to rival Pelé, the great soccer star, as far as Brazilian press coverage was concerned. The story of Puharich's TMS operation caused a sensation. It disturbed Puharich and Belk because such sensationalism might turn off the responsible support they needed. It also foreshadowed the problems they might have in returning for more depth research. It wasn't TMT the kind of thing that could be done in a glass cage. A wide press would also be damaging if some of the publicity filtered up to the United States before the facts had been assessed and put in proper perspective. To harness the research properly, Puharich would have to begin with the concrete and medically recognizable. From here, the exploration would naturally have to travel out of conventional orbit, simply by the nature of what Arrigo did. But first things had to come first. One of the basic facts at hand was that when Arrigo used a knife on a patient, there was overwhelming evidence, if not proof, that the knife did not hurt. The second basic was that when he cut into the patient a TMS body, the wound did not bleed, or at least stopped bleeding on Arrigo's TMS verbal command. The 53rd basic was that the wound from the unsterile knife did not become infected. These were the things that would have to be examined medically from every possible angle. Where the research trail would lead from there was impossible to tell. In reviewing his notes of both his direct observations and the film sequences, Puharich tried to justify what he saw in line with his medical training. He was thinking specifically of the cataract operations Arrigo had performed with such ease and speed, a matter of seconds. In conventional surgery, the patient is completely immobilized under deep anesthesia. Complete scrubbing and sterilization is imperative. The operation aid to remove the clouded lens of the eye, A under these conditions varies from 10 to 30 minutes. Arrigo, whose hands and knife worked so fast, seemed to carelessly plunge a blade into the cornea of the eye of a fully conscious patient standing against the wall, and the lens seemed to pop out almost magically. Yet there was no magic or sleight of hand here, because Puharich had examined the patient before, during, and after the process, and verified that the lens of the eye had been removed. The more he reflected on it, the more incredible it was. Or the hydrocele drainage, which he had seen clearly in the film. Some hydroceles are classified as elephantiasis. This is a chronic condition where the tissues of the scrotum become enormously enlarged as the lymphatic fluid builds up in the sac and doesn't TMT drain away. In some exaggerated cases, a wheelbarrow must be used to support the enlarged organ. It is most often caused by a nematode worm called Wachereria bancrofti. The usual medical practice is to drain the sac with a needle for temporary relief, after anesthetizing the area completely. This is repeated, along with antibiotic medication, as the condition demands. But it does not get rid of the blockage of the lymphatic tubes that caused the condition. In some cases, the testicle must be amputated. But Arrigo drained his cases without anesthesia, and was reported to have brought about permanent cures. It was this sort of thing, along with the myriad other treatments Arrigo used, that would have to be examined and 54, analyzed. By the time Belk and Puharich returned to the United States, Puharich was already blocking out the areas they needed to explore. The entire personal history of Arrigo would have to be gathered and studied. What were the roots of this capacity that enabled Arrigo to do what he did? How was his psychological background formed, and what influenced it? What about his early boyhood? What triggered him into launching this unusual career? How could he possibly work so indefatigably, handling hundreds of patients a day? Where did he learn his pharmacology? The A. Dr. Fritz's TM theory was so incredible, it was hard to consider. While Arrigo's TMS handwriting was crude, the spelling of the most complex modern pharmaceuticals was correct, from antibiotics to courtesans, from the leading drug manufacturers of the world. And they were written at lightning speed. It was essential that answers to all these questions be found in order to understand the phenomenon. Belk had his reflections, too. What was most difficult for him was to put what he had observed into the disciplines of parapsychology. But one very real piece of evidence was foremost in his mind. Within 3 weeks after he had started taking the medically irrational prescription Arago had given him, his backache had disappeared. 3. In 1950, 13 years before Puharich and Belk came to Congonhas do Campo on their research expedition, Brazilian Senator Lucio Bittencourt lay on his bed in his room at the Hotel Financial in Belo Horizonte. There were many conflicting thoughts going through his mind. The campaign for the national and state elections of that year was tough and vigorous. He was not only running for re-election as senator, but had taken on the added chore of stomping through the mountain expanse of the state of Minas Gerais on behalf of Getatilda Superscripto Lio Vargas, the quixotic presidential candidate who had dominated Brasilia's political life for many years. Vargas was now in the process of staging a comeback, after a 5-year hiatus forced on him by a military junta. With 2 campaigns to run, one for Vargas and one for himself, Senator Bittencourt had his hands full. But there was another complication, a serious one. He had been told by his doctor in Rio de Janeiro that laboratory tests showed he was suffering from lung cancer, and that his only hope was an immediate operation. Otherwise, there was little chance he would survive. His doctor had recommended an operation in the United States, where some of the surgical techniques for this particular type of operation were more advanced. Senator Bittencourt fully intended following his physician at EMS advice. But he felt so intensely about the political struggle he was involved in that he postponed the decision until after his campaign sweep through Minas Gerais. Dedicated to the cause of the Partido Tribalista de Brasileiro A, the Brazilian workers at EM Party A, he felt that only Vargas would be able to continue pushing for more benevolent treatment for labor and more progressive steps in agriculture and education. The senator had recently stopped in Congonhas do Campo. Although it was a small village, it was politically important because it was deep in the heart of the iron mining district, and the miners faced an uphill struggle 56, against poverty and deplorable working conditions. He had been impressed with the dynamic, 32-year-old former union president who greeted him on his arrival in the town. His name was José Tilda Copyright Pedro de Freitas, and he was obviously strong as an ox, extremely vital, and a natural leader dedicated to the cause of the workers. It took little time to discover that José Tilda Copyright was known everywhere as Arigo, a word in Brazil that translates roughly as a jovial country bumpkin at EM, but was well loved in spite of it. The senator was quick to recognize Arigo at EM's considerable magnetism and crude good nature. Arigo, in turn, rankling under the dismal working conditions of the miners, assured Senator Bittencourt of the support of his union. Welcoming the assistance, the senator invited Arigo to bring a group of his miners into Belo Horizonte for a rally to be held the next day. After they arrived in the city, they found that the rally had been postponed for a day. The senator invited Arigo to stay overnight at the Hotel Financial, a towering, modern hotel on the Avenida Afonso Pena in the bright, new, growing city. Arigo, although he had a great fear of elevators, agreed to stay and registered in a room down the hall from the senator. He insisted, however, on walking up 3 flights to do so. That evening they joined other campaign workers at a churrasco at the Churrascaria Campons, where barbecued meats were piled high along with feijão, black beans seasoned with onions, garlic, and spices, and arroz de galinha, rice blended with chicken, boiled eggs, and olives. It was a festive evening, and there was a bountiful supply of chope, the frothy Brazilian beer. Arigo had a glass or two of wine, although he seldom drank. The festivities carried through until late in the night. Although the worries about his health hung heavily over the senator, he joined in with the others, quaffing a considerable number of mugs of his favorite dark beer. Sometime after midnight, the senator and Arago returned to the Hotel Financial, walking through the wide, deserted avenues of the city. Senator Bittencourt had trouble getting to sleep. The combination of the stress of the political campaign and the worry about his physical 57 condition did not lead to quietude. The senator did not recall just how long he lay tossing in his bed. He was aware, though, that just when he felt he might doze off, the door to his room opened. In the half-light from the hallway spilling through the door, he could not clearly tell who it was. The shape of the man was similar to the burly contours of Arago, and as the light switch was snapped on, he saw that it was. Arago was holding a razor in his hand. His eyes were glazed, with a far-off look, as if he saw nothing in front of him. He crossed to Senator Bittencourt at TMS bed, as the senator gaped in wordless amazement. He recalled feeling very faint, as his vision blurred and the figure of Arago dissolved into an indiscernible form. But for some reason, he felt no fear whatever. Perhaps he was hallucinating, he thought. He did not cry out, did not try to address Arago. He remembered hearing Arago TMS voice, in a very thick German accent. The voice said there was an emergency and that there would have to be an operation. At that point, Senator Bittencourt blacked out. When he came to again, the light was still on and his watch showed that it was 5 in the morning. There was no one in the room. He felt very weak and faint, but he sat up quickly as the memory of Arago TMS entry into the room flooded back to him. The recollection was hazy at first, but it began putting itself together in his mind. He remembered clearly Arago coming into the room, razor in hand. He remembered Arago approaching his bed and speaking to him in a thick guttural accent about the need for an emergency operation. He remembered having no fear. His memory could not, however, penetrate beyond the moment at which he blacked out. He quickly took off his pajama top and looked at it. There was a fairly large bloodstain on it, and part of it had been slashed. He got up shakily and went to the mirror. Turning his back to it, he saw a clean, neat incision in the dorsal area of the rib cage. The blood had already clotted. Moving slowly, because of his faintness, he dressed. He was now shaken and frightened, if not panicked. His calm 58-ness, so inexplicable at the time Arago came toward his bed with the razor, was shattered. Leaving the blood-stained pajamas on his bed, he walked down the hall to Arago TMS room. His legs were still weak. He knocked on the door, and Arago, half asleep, opened it. The senator said that he desperately needed a cup of tea, and wanted Arago to go to a pharmacy with him at once. He would explain everything later. Puzzled and confused, Arago quickly dressed and joined him. In silence they walked down the Avenida Afonso Pena to a sleepy pharmacy. They entered the establishment, and Bittencourt asked for a cup of tea, explaining that he did not feel well. Then his knees buckled under him and he collapsed on the floor. Arago attended to him while the clerk rushed to the street to find a policeman. He was back in moments with one. By this time, Bittencourt was beginning to revive. Arago, by now assuming that the senator had had too much to drink, explained the situation in those terms. After Bittencourt gulped down the cup of tea, he said he was feeling better, and felt strong enough to return to the hotel. Walking slowly back, he told Arago that the reason he had fainted was that Arago had come into his room and operated on his back. Arago was shocked. He accused the senator of having drunk too much beer, but Bittencourt held to his story. He admitted that at first he thought he was hallucinating, but now the memory was clear in his mind. The bloodstain on his pajamas and the incision on his back would prove it. Arago protested that he had done no such thing. Back in the senator TMS room, however, he studied the slashed pajamas, the bloodstain, and the incision. There was no question that Bittencourt had been operated on. The wound was fresh, the blood still moist, but he insisted he had had nothing to do with it. Senator Bittencourt, worried and distraught, said he was leaving immediately for the airport to catch the first plane to Rio to see his doctor. Arago was almost in a state of shock. although he had no memory whatever of going to the Senator at EMS room. A series of strange spells had been plaguing him for a long period of 59 time. He helped Senator Bittencourt into a taxi, mumbling almost incoherently that if he had done anything like this, he had no memory whatever of doing so. With the senator on his way to the airport, Arrigo got into his jeep. He was tense and nervous. Whatever had happened, he knew himself well enough to know that he would never do anything out of malice or foolhardiness. Yet if he had done this incredible thing, he obviously must be bordering on insanity. He prayed that Senator Bittencourt, a TMS doctor, would find that he had done no harm, if, indeed, he had done anything at all. The hour and a half it takes to drive from Belo Horizonte to Congonhas do Campo allowed Arrigo considerable time for reflection. From what had been happening to him over the past several years, he was convinced that what Senator Bittencourt had described might very well have taken place, even though Arrigo had no memory of it. It was hard to define when it all started. Arrigo had been born on his father at EMS farm on October 18, 1918, and his early boyhood varied little from the norm. He was one of eight brothers, all of them healthy and robust, and none of them suffering from any real deprivation. The father, Antonio de Freitas Sobrano, owned several parcels of land and farmed them diligently. He was also one of the town fathers of Congonhas do Campo. He had, in fact, been chairman of the town council, and continued to sit on the board. Some of Arrigo's TMS relatives were even considered wealthy, including an aunt who had large ranch holdings and an uncle who was to become mayor of the town. Although most of his brothers went on to higher education, including one who had a law degree and another who was a priest, Arrigo was not a good student and dropped out after struggling through the first 3 years of school. He contented himself with working in the fields of his father at EMS farm, living an unstructured boyhood that allowed him time to spend with the many friends that collected around him. He was very popular. He was garrulous and congenial, sinewy and strong from his earliest years. His formal name of José Tilda copyright Pedro de Freitas was dropped early in favor of 60, Arrigo, which, in spite of its suggestion of hillbilly qualities, was used affectionately by his friends. Arrigo did not mind it, he actually enjoyed it. Even in his brief school years, he was bothered by what he described as a bright, round light, so brilliant that it nearly blinded me at EM. He also experienced moderately persistent audio hallucinations, describing them as a voice that spoke in a strange language at EM. These were infrequent enough to brush off, and he learned to put up with them. He also refrained from discussing them at length with anyone, including his family. The entire de Freitas family was devoutly Catholic, and Arrigo grew up in that tradition. The Church of Bom Jesus do Matosinhos, high on the steep hill overlooking the red tile roofs of the village, and guarded by the almost breathtaking statues of Elia Jadino, fostered reverence and devotion, even for non-Catholics. Arrigo worshipped and believed in his faith with the intensity that marked everything he did. He was outspoken, with little regard for subtleties or niceties. He often used barnyard language, but he did so with a certain charm that nullified criticism. He spoke his mind bluntly, spontaneously. He was at times grossly flamboyant, yet he was sensitive. He was often moved to tears, even as a man. He was affectionate, embracing his friends, with fire at EM, as a friend put it. He was compassionate. He loved people, especially children. He was obstinate and unyielding, often to his own disadvantage. Congonhas do Campo was a Catholic town. There were two monasteries on the nearby mountaintops, at times reachable only by jeep. Arrigo's TMS family, in their religious devotion, were disproportionately lavish in their contributions to both the church and the monasteries. While Catholicism in Brazil is more relaxed and less dominant than it is in the Spanish-speaking Latin republics, it is still a powerful force, and 90% of the population professes to be part of it. However, as Pedro McGregor points out in his illuminating book The Moon and Two Mountains, the Spiritist groups, frowned on by the Catholics, had 71 orphanages against 73 for the Catholics and 25 for the Protestants. As for social assistance shelters, the Spiritists, with 61, their emphasis on charity, had 125, compared to 81 for the Catholics and 25 for the Protestants.